Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we're going to talk about Einstein and lasers. We have some great images for you to look at while you're listening to the audio track. So open a second window, go to our website, guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, and bring up today's show, Einstein and Lasers. Let's talk first about how a laser works, what is a laser, and then we'll talk about some of the interesting applications that we use lasers for. So, like many things, lasers begin with a discussion of atoms. Image number one on the website shows you an electron orbiting the nucleus of an atom. So the nucleus is the very small yellow dot in the center, and the electron is shown as sort of a green circle orbiting around the nucleus. And we'll start off by thinking that the electron is orbiting the nucleus in a way that's not very different from how a planet might orbit a star, like Earth orbiting the Sun. It's not a perfect analogy, but let's begin with that. Okay, so we have an electron at a certain distance from the nucleus in a circular orbit around the nucleus. And as the figure shows, just to make it easier to see, let's cut this circular orbit at the 12 o'clock position, which I've called A, and stretch out that ribbon into a straight line. So if, and that's what we have in the upper right in the image, you see one end of the ribbon is called A, and the center of the ribbon, which would be 6 o'clock on the circular orbit, is called B, and the right end of the ribbon is A again, because we cut the ribbon at 12 o'clock, and so one end of the ribbon is 12 o'clock, and the other end of the ribbon is also 12 o'clock, because that's the end of the circle. So our linear straight line ribbon that we have across the top is something like a map of the Earth, with the prime meridian down the center, that corresponds to B. And at the left and right edges of the map, you have the international dateline. You go all the way to the east, and you reach the international dateline. You go all the way to the west, and you also reach the international dateline. And that's often the way a map is presented. But all of us know that the Earth is really round, and so the international dateline is the same on the left side of the map as the right. So the A in the figure on the left end of the strip has to match the A on the right end of the strip, because in reality, since it's a circle, those are really the same place. Okay, so previously we talked about Einstein's discovery that light is both a particle and a wave, and this was extended by others to recognize that particles are also have wave characteristics. Particles are also a particle and a wave. So an electron, being a particle, has a wave property. And in fact, it has a wavelength. And it's going to be waving up and down as it goes around the atom. Okay, well, something special has to happen here to make this a valid orbit. Because if it starts off, as the figure shows, with a peak in its wave at A, as it goes around its orbit and ends up back at A, it has to end up at a peak also. because it can't have two different values at A. It can't have a peak at the left A and a trough at the right A, because A is the same in both cases. It's the 12 o'clock position on the circle. So Niels Bohr proposed that for an electron to have a stable orbit around a nucleus, it had to have an even number of wavelengths around its orbit. So the circumference of the orbit had to be an integer number of wavelengths. And that gives us the little equation at the bottom of this slide. 2 pi r, the radius of the orbit. 2 pi r, therefore, is their circumference. 2 pi r has to be n times the wavelength. N is some integer. Moving to image number 2 on the website, we see that an atom that has multiple electrons has to have those electrons in specific orbital positions around the nucleus. So now we see that atoms are really different from a solar system. A planet can orbit a star at any distance at all and still have a stable orbit. But an electron cannot orbit a nucleus at any distance at all because its wavelength has to match up as it goes around the nucleus. So there will be an allowed orbit very close to the nucleus in which the electron will have one wavelength around the entire circumference. There will be a larger orbit further from the nucleus in which the electron will have two wavelengths. Since it's further from the nucleus, it'll have a different energy and a different wavelength, so it's not the same wavelength as the central orbit, but still at that position, whatever the wavelength is, there have to be exactly an integral number of them around the circumference, in this case two. And further out yet, there will be an orbit in which there are three wavelengths all the way around the circumference. So this means that the electrons have to be in specific orbits. They have to have specific distances that from the nucleus. They're not allowed to be just anywhere. They have to have specific energies, therefore. And so Niels Bohr's model reflects the fact, which we discover by experiment, that atoms have their electrons in very specific energy levels. And every different type of atom has a different set of energy levels which its electrons occupy. It's a unique set of energy levels for each atom type, and that set of energy levels gives us a unique fingerprint for every type of atom. Now, for an electron to move from one energy level to the other, it either has to emit a photon of light or absorb a photon of light. If it's going to move to a higher energy level, it has to absorb a photon which has exactly the right amount of energy to move the electron from a very specific energy to another very specific energy. Energy is conserved, so the electron can only move up if it absorbs a photon that has exactly that required energy, which means the photon has to have a very specific frequency. If the electron is going to move down to a lower energy level, it will emit a photon, and that photon will have exactly the right amount of energy to correspond to the difference in the energy levels of the electron. So as the electron moves down to conserve energy, it will emit a photon of a very specific frequency. And again, the set of all those frequencies that a certain type of atom can emit or absorb is unique to each type of atom. Hydrogen has one set of frequencies, helium has another, oxygen has a different one, carbon has a different one, and so forth. Every element on the periodic table has a unique set of frequencies. Okay, so what does all this have to do with lasers? Well, you can build a laser following the theory that Einstein developed by constructing a system in which you have a large number of atoms that have two possible energy levels for one of their electrons. And if you manage to lift all the electrons to the upper energy level, which is something that engineers have mechanisms to do, it's called pumping, then those electrons will over time drop down to the lower energy level and emit their photon. And if these are all the same type of atoms, then the photons that the electrons will emit will all be the same frequency. Well, as Einstein said, if you make the design of the system proper, you can cause these atoms to emit their photons all together at the same time and all together in the same direction. Looking at image number 3 on the website, when the first atom has its electron drop to a lower energy level and emit a photon, that will make it more likely for the second atom to do the same thing. And when the second atom emits its photon also, that'll make it even more likely for the third atom to do the same thing. And as more and more atoms emit photons which have this very specific energy, then that will enhance even further the probability that the subsequent atoms will follow suit. And pretty soon you have an avalanche of all of these atoms emitting their photons at the same time in the same direction and producing what's called a coherent beam of photons. And that is what a laser is, a coherent beam of photons. It is an enormous number of photons which all have the same frequency, the same color, if you will, and they are all moving in the same direction. That is very much different than, for instance, the light that comes out of your standard light bulb, which covers a very large range of frequencies, and the photons are moving in all kinds of directions. So a laser beam can be 100,000 times more confined in its energy and direction than a standard light source. And this gives us an amazingly precise tool with which we can do all kinds of wonderful things. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos. I am your host, Robert Piccioni. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and this is Guide to the Cosmos. Today we are talking about Einstein and lasers. Some of the applications for lasers are shown in image number 4 on the website. We use them to sculpt our corneas in LASIK surgery. They're used to treat glaucoma and also diabetes, which is the leading cause of blindness. They're also used to remove cataracts. And during open heart surgery, for example, as the upper image shows, surgeons can use lasers to make very precise surgical incisions into the heart. You can also use a laser in a mode in which a fiber optic cable is inserted, let's say, in the femoral artery in the leg and threaded up toward the heart, And then when you get to the right position, you can use the laser to blast away deposits in your coronary blood vessels, as illustrated in the lower right image. And it's used in all sorts of industrial applications where you want to finally machine something and have very precise control over the cutting width and the cutting depth and the temperature at which the material is exposed. Lasers can be used to remove tattoos or unwanted hair and also port wine stains. And lasers can be used for dental surgery because you can make a laser pulse that's so short, 30 trillionths of a second, that the human nervous system can't respond and indicate pain. So the laser pulse can be so short that the patient doesn't feel any pain at all. Lasers can also be used for various artistic applications, including the removal of surface contamination for an object of art. Recently, in the catacombs under the city of Rome, the tomb of St. Peter was discovered, and over thousands of years it had been covered by inches of calcium deposits. And using lasers, people were able to remove these calcium deposits almost atomic layer by atomic layer until they got to the casket itself, which had been beautifully decorated. Lasers are also used in astronomy to compensate for the variability of the Earth's atmosphere. One of the problems that astronomers have in looking at very distant objects is that the atmosphere blurs the image of those objects. And what has been done recently to overcome that is that the observatory will shine a laser next to the telescope upward toward the top of the atmosphere. And using the right frequency, the laser will excite atoms that are in the top of the atmosphere and cause them to glow, creating, if you will, a fake star. Then the telescope can image that fake star, and computers can analyze the image and adjust the shape of the mirror of the telescope to eliminate the blur in the fake star. If you eliminate the blur in the fake star, then you have eliminated the blur that's caused by that same atmospheric condition in the image of the very distant galaxy or star that you're actually looking at. So this is called adaptive optics, and it's incorporated in most of the finest ground-based telescopes. The space-based telescopes don't need that, of course, because they're above the atmosphere. Lasers are also used for range finding. You emit a laser beam, it bounces off something and comes back, and you calculate how long it took for the laser beam to return. Then, knowing the speed of light, you can figure out what the distance was. So this is used in construction. The military uses it for range finding. And one of the more interesting laser range finding applications is to study the distance to the moon. And we've discovered that the moon is actually moving away from the Earth at about 1.5 inches a year. And this is measured very precisely by bouncing a laser off a reflector that was deliberately left on the moon for this purpose by the Apollo 11 astronauts. Lasers are also used for scanning barcodes at grocery stores and other retail outlets. They're used for reading our CDs and DVDs. They're used for carrying our telephone and internet communications across fiber optic cables. You probably couldn't even listen to my radio show if you weren't using laser beams across fiber optic cables accessing the internet. And of course, they're used for laser printers, for the fabrication of semiconductor and solar cells, for communicating with deep space satellites, in ring diodes, in fluoroscopy, and lithography. Lasers are also used to take extremely high speed images. If you want to take a stroboscopic image of high speed action and sort of freeze frame it, you need a fast light source. And the fastest light sources that we have are made with lasers. Indeed, the state of the art nowadays is a laser that is 50 thousandths of 1 trillionth of a second. 50 thousandths of 1 trillionth of a second. And with that, scientists hope to see individual electrons from one atom to the next as chemical reactions occur. Lasers are also being used in an effort to try to get an economically viable nuclear fusion system. There is something called the National Ignition Facility, which is located in Livermore, California, in which 192 incredibly powerful lasers are all focused on a fuel pellet simultaneously. And the effort there is to get that fuel pellet to compress when it's hit by all these lasers, to get its temperature to rise to hundreds of millions of degrees and initiate nuclear fusion, delivering vastly more energy out than it took to fire the lasers. That's still a work in progress. Lasers are also used in one of the most advanced astronomical observatories of all, which is looking for gravity waves. These would be waves in the fabric of space-time that Einstein predicted, which might be caused, for instance, when two black holes merge together. This gravity wave observatory is called LIGO, L-I-G-O, and it is based on a measurement of two distances at 90 degrees using laser beams. The arrangement is so precise that they hope to see changes in distance that correspond to 1% of the width of an atom over a distance of about 2.5 miles. There is one of these facilities in Washington State and another in Louisiana. By timing the difference in arrival of the gravity wave at the two different sites, they would be able to determine where the gravity wave came from. So lasers are nearly ubiquitous in our society, and all of them are based on Einstein's original concept that a coherent beam of photons could be created. Thank you for tuning in, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.